This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport, powered by fans.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, whether that's Rovers throwing in a drab 0-0 in the Championship or taking Newcastle all the way to a penalty shootout in the fifth round of the FA Cup, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. So, the only thing left to say is, are you in? Order now on the McDonald's app, and you can also get rewards points delivered too. So, the ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants, 18+. Rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hello, this is Sam Swaddix here, and welcome to the 4,000 Holes podcast.
You are listening to the 4,000 Holes podcast, brought to you by the people at brfcs.com and sponsored by the lovely people at The Terrace.
Welcome everybody to this edition of the Roundtable Show on the 4,000 Holes podcast, and we've got a special guest tonight. I love talking to creative people, especially musicians. I love talking to Rovers fans. So tonight we've got one of those fantastic situations where the Venn diagram overlaps and we've got somebody who's slap bang in the middle of that. So welcome to the 4,000 Holes podcast, Tom Fleming, and we'll talk about your alter ego in due course, but for the moment we'll call you Tom if that's okay. Tom, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. That is the name my mother gave me. So I'm very well, thank you, very well. I mean, I must say it's a sort of personal ambition of mine to be the centre of that Venn diagram, so thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure, absolutely. So where are we finding you tonight? Where are you at the moment? Where is home?
I'm at home down south. I'm in my house.
Where down south?
I'm in sort of like the exurbs of London.
Ah, right. So you are in that there London, because I did wonder whether.
Yeah, well, not quite, but you know, around.
Fantastic, excellent stuff. So let's learn a little bit about you, the individual, Tom, and then we'll talk about you, the Rovers fan, and why you're a Rovers fan, and how that emerged all this. And then obviously we'll talk about your music career, if that's okay. So that's what we've got lined up for you now, listeners. So tell us about yourself then. So where are you from originally, and where, more pertinently, where did that Blackburn Rovers connection come from?
Well, I'm originally from a town called Kendal in Cumbria, which is right south Cumbria, so like virtually Lancashire. And I'm going to show my age here, but I was sort of like maybe getting interested in football around sort of early to mid 90s. And, you know, a lot of my friends effectively at school, it's Man United or Liverpool.
Yeah.
You know, and everyone was in red shirts, and like me being a contrary bugger wanted to do something, you know, look something else. And like Blackburn were a very exciting team at the time, right down the road, because we don't need to talk about Preston.
Like, no, absolutely,
you know,
not.
They were so like very local team, very exciting, banging loads of goals, great players coming through, and a real like kind of like, I guess I don't want to say nouveau riche, but like new blood of the time.
Well, it's challenging the established order, I think I would prefer to put it. Yeah,
so
it's
sort of like, as you say,
it was Manchester United. It was, well, Liverpool throughout the 80s, certainly for me. And Liverpool, Manchester United, and then Arsenal started to emerge, didn't they, with Rovers in the 90s and all the rest of it. But Rovers back in the day, back at that time, had a lot of supporters clubs in the Lakes and Morecambe and Lancaster and down that way. So were you ever a member of one of those?
I was a member. Yeah, I never travelled on the buses, but I was a member of my local club. Yeah.
And can you remember your first game?
I can remember my first game. I went with my dad. Took me for my birthday. I must have been 10 or 11. I'm not sure which. But my dad's not a football fan at all, so he was doing me a solid there. But it was Leeds. It was Ewood Park against Leeds. I think Gary McAllister was the Leeds captain, so that's how long ago it was. But it was a very drab, wintry 1-1 draw, so that sets you up for your whole lifetime of supporting Rovers. But I think I found out later on Match of the Day that Tim Flowers had been sent off within a few minutes.
And I remember that game. Yeah, it was midweek, wasn't it? Yeah, and Bobby Mims.
It was midweek. Oh,
yeah, I think think that's the game that Peter White in the Lancashire Telegraph gave Alan Shearer a perfect 10 out of 10. And said
he was
the most magnificent performance, considering Rovers had 10 men. He was absolutely everywhere.
A chance in 60 seconds for Alan Shearer, who's been absolutely prolific against Leeds United. Here's Brian Dean at the other end. He's away from Flowers, where he would have been. Now referee's blood is with him. What a dramatic start here. Flowers way outside of his penalty area. What will Roger Gifford deem the necessary action? Ewood Park holds its breath. Red. 1 minute, 35 seconds. And that's the sum total of the night for Tim Flowers.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as if you don't have many to choose from. Back then, he was an absolute monster in his youth. I mean, obviously, I was a kid, so I'm sort of like reconstructing memories. But like, you know, he offered so much more than just goals. And if you look back on his highlights now from that era, like every goal's a screamer.
Oh, absolutely!
Every goal's like a 25-yard drive.
It's like, just ridiculous, isn't it? What he used to be able to do. I mean, for someone of your age. To see him and recognise his ability and all the rest of it. Believe me, for someone of my age who was brought up on free transfer signings from Bolton's reserves or Wigan Athletic
Absolutely.
I never ever thought I'd see some of the things that we saw in the 1990s. It's an extraordinary time to be a Rovers fan. It's understandable how you linked in that. So how often do you manage to see the team? Do you manage to get to any away games or anything like that?
I haven't been since the pandemic ended. I lived in Leeds. I used to go home games occasionally.
Right.
When I lived in London, I try and go to sort of 3, 4, 5 away games. But yeah, because obviously there's loads of teams in and around London.
Yeah.
We've been up to Birmingham, across to Bristol. When we were in League One, I was going to Oxford and AFC Wimbledon and stuff. So like, you know, I have been around. I must admit, I've dropped off a bit in recent years. But
I think COVID gave people new habits, didn't it? I mean, I did live in London for a period of time, and I was a member of the London branch of the Supporters Club, and I used it as an opportunity to tick off some new grounds and get around some stadia. I wish I'd done more now. Actually, it would have.
Well, I mean, because of my vintage, you know, like getting into Rovers in the mid 90s, they're all a lot like me. So like I'm especially going to the games in London, it's sort of guys with sort of like in suspiciously fashionable dress, like, you know, with good jobs and then the arts or whatever, and like, you know, like leather jackets, like cheering on, and then like 17-year-old lads from Blackburn effing and blinding. It's just brilliant, like the sort of combo when everyone's getting on and stuff. Away games are brilliant.
How did you find that year in League One then, that promotion season?
I mean, it was obviously going down was a tragedy.
Yeah.
Obviously, I remember going to Barnsley away with Owen Coyle. That felt like that was the low point. Because like it was I can't remember who it was. It was a red card for a completely brainless tackle.
Darragh Lenihan, as I recall. I think that's right. But I was at that game. The vitriol.
Oh, wait, really?
Vitriol at full time was quite something.
You were half time. It was bad enough. We shouldn't have been there, and it was pretty obvious from the performances that we were cut above. So it did feel a little bit. I like to see myself as a champion of the underdog. So like it did feel a little bit flat track bully.
punching you down instead of up.
Well, like going to Oxford and actually Wimbledon and taking the piss and stuff. But it was also like wonderful because like it was a lot of people would have got hacked off by that experience. It was like some of my most heartening times being a Rovers fan was like actually going to those games and like seeing that people did really care about the team and obviously going to grounds where, like, you know, if you're an Oxford United fan, there's not much glory waiting for you. Do you know what I mean? But the ground is pretty full, you know, on a freezing night in February or whatever it was. You know, it is it is a cliche to talk about, like, top-level football as a bit of a dead zone, but, like, it is just different. I mean, the Championship's amazing. You know, it's carnage, and you don't know what's going to happen, as evidenced by this season. But But you just don't know. It's just, it is genuinely a complete crapshoot.
It absolutely is. It's a bonkers division. And obviously we're at the wrong end of it at the moment, but fingers crossed that will come out. But I have a theory about that promotion season, that it re-energized a moribund club. In that I think
you might be right.
Things were just so down, and obviously relegation, Mowbray coming in nearly kept us up, didn't quite. But there was something about that. It was almost like a make or break. And there's a new generation of supporters that have come through in the 7 or 8 years since then that will see that as their high point. I mean, for those of us lucky enough to see us win the league and the League Cup and all the rest of it, it's a bit sad that is the high point. But having said that, I thought that my Rovers sporting high point would be winning the third division in 1975. So I'm quite pleased that we've been able to better that at least.
Yeah. Well, I think I kind of agree with that, to be honest. I think that it did bring a lot of sort of, because I mean, before that, I mean, the seasons leading up to that were very depressing. I mean, you know, like you said, the Owen Coyle stuff, but like way before that, Steve Keane, and I mean, I barely say his name on this podcast. No, but
we can bleep it out if necessary, don't we?
Yeah, please do. I'm sorry for my language, but. But you know, it got quite grim, and like there was a particular that when we went down for the Premier League, where like we needed to. It was a draw with Wigan, I think. It was a goalless draw, and we needed to win, and we didn't even register, not even a shot on target, but a shot.
The chicken and on the pitch.
Like, for me, that was the nadir of like, there's nothing, you know, that something needs to change, and finally it did. And I thought, obviously, I mean, I think Mowbray served his time, and sort of like John Dal Thomason coming in maybe sort of like did something to the team. But, you know, I think Mowbray covered his name in glory, I think, in terms of what he did for the club in redirecting.
He brought common sense to play, I think. Yeah. Which was, Rovers were known as the madhouse club, and he seemed to calm everything down. I think his time was up, in fairness.
I agree.
I think a manager, but we saw Alex Ferguson at United, every now and then he would either strip out his coaching staff or get rid of five players. And I think we were at that point where we needed to either do that or get rid of the manager. And it was obviously a lot cheaper to say to the manager, well, your contract's expired. So it's been nice, Tony. But I have to say, the JDT season was the most exciting football I think I've seen Rovers play since the Mark Hughes days with Ben.
It was, I mean, and also, like, obviously there's a lot going on behind the scenes at the moment, which probably led to his departure. But, and I mean, obviously the results haven't been good, but I'm not sure that's his door. I come and go on that. Yeah. But certainly it felt like a proper manager. I believe he's got to the Sweden team, hasn't he?
He has, Swedish national team.
He's a serious manager, do you know what I mean?
I think he was always destined for better things than us. I kind of just hoped
you know that, but then you accept that, don't you? You accept that's part of it. You don't, anyone who thinks that, you know, that like a manager like that, pinnacle is going to be Blackburn, I think you're probably a bit deluded.
Yeah.
But that's the joy of supporting Rovers. It's like, no, you know, always punching above our weight, always like knowing what we are.
The most successful town team in the league, as the banner he would say.
I believe it's the highest proportion of fans to population of town or something like that.
Oh, you'll probably get Burnley fans arguing with that, so let's not go there.
No need to watch your language. Actually, Alex, I work closely at my record label, Domino. He's a diehard Burnley fan.
Oh dear.
And it's a source of constant amusement. Like, seeking incentives about keeping the bastards down forever and all this, and me talking about White Lives Matter and all that sort of stuff. You know,
I just want us to have the opportunity to play them next season, because if they go down and we go down, that would be a disaster in more ways than one. Because I think we're due to bloody the nose once, and they can't keep indulging Vincent Kompany with all the sort of nonsense. So we shall see.
We've had a few humblings, and to be fair, I was always saying to you, I've got a couple of Burnley supporting friends who are like, you know, they're what we used to be in many ways.
Well, I think they're role models. I mean, and again, that sticks in the craw, having to said that. But yeah, but they, before the American owners took over, they were the epitome of how to cut your cloth accordingly and make best use of the resources. And anybody who sort of said, well, I don't see how Rovers can get back in the Premier League, well, you did point to Burnley, but now you point to Luton. So to crack it, you can do it on a stadium that seats 10,000 that's falling down. You know, surely to goodness we can do something. But anyhow, fingers crossed we can stay up and renew that rivalry.
Next year.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like seeing Sammy Smodics get the winner at Ewood Park. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Are you in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee, and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Right, let's move on to you then and understand how music came into your life and what you're doing now and how the listeners might want to get more involved with all that sort of stuff. So what's your earliest recollection of music or musical artists? Who were your biggest influences?
Oh God! Well, I mean, I'm from a musical family. My dad taught piano. He was a church organist, so music was like that was a constant presence. Like I'm more likely to hear an instrument being played than record or radio. Right. So like that came from that sort of background. Obviously, I listened to a lot of music. I had an older brother who introduced me to a lot of stuff, neighbors and stuff. Like when I was a kid, I was a big metalhead, believe it or not. And when I was about 12, 13, is when I started playing guitar. Before that, I was some kind of recorder prodigy. I was like, I'd like taken grades and stuff by about 7 or 8. And if it was a serious instrument, I would be a prodigy. But as it is, it's a bit of a joke, which is a shame. but I took up guitar about 10 or 11 and sort of never looked back.
So who are your favourite guitarists?
Oh, God, I like folk players. I like folk singers. Martin Carthy, John Fahey, John Renbourn, Bert Jansch.
So you've left the metal thing behind then? You're not sort of...
Sometimes I have bad days and sometimes you need a bit of it. But like, adults who only listen to metal, I do wonder about them because it's like, you know...
I'm a resident of Sheffield, so I just wondered if Def Leppard featured in there.
I'm a huge Def Leppard fan. I saw Def Leppard at the Royal Albert Hall and there's like... their like War Child thing they did or something.
It was ace.
I mean, they're fantastic. In fact, when I met my girlfriend, we bonded very heavily about Def Leppard, about Hysteria and Pyromania and all that. Yeah, I mean, of all the bands to come out of Sheffield, there are many great bands to come out of Sheffield, but yeah, Def Leppard don't get the respect they deserve.
No, I had tickets to see them a few years ago, I think just before COVID, with Cheap Trick on the bill. And I can remember buying a Cheap Trick album on yellow vinyl back in the day, live at Budokan. And I thought, that's a great bill. Got to get me a ticket for that. And I got food poisoning the day before.
Oh my goodness!
And
I couldn't go.
And I was like heartbroken. So I keep fingers crossed that at some point, you know, that tour will come around again. So as I say, I'm not fully stamped up on my Sheffield band's cards yet.
Maybe it was all the artificial sweetness you got from listening to the music.
Quite possibly. Oh. So that you started playing at an early age then. Was the guitar always your instrument, or guitar and keyboard as well?
I can play piano, but I'm not good by any means. Guitar is definitely my main thing. I play a few things, like, you know, related string instruments and like mess around with synthesizers and drum machines and stuff. Yeah. But these days I'm primarily an acoustic guitar player, to be honest. Maybe that's just me getting old. But I think what it is me re-engaging with the teenager I was when I was sort of 16, 17, discovering loads of, like, not just contemporary stuff, because a lot of that was happening in America at the time, these kind of, like, weird folk musicians coming out. But also, I think growing up in South Cumbria, there is actually, like, there's, like, a kind of traditional folk scene, a lot coming over from Ireland as well. Oh, so, okay. Like, all that stuff kind of, like, came to the table as well. And I sort of went back to that, whenever I run out of ideas, I kind of try and go back to the source where possible. So that's what I'm doing, really.
When did you think that music could become a career? Because I can just imagine the conversation with a careers master at school. No, you need a proper job, lad. You know, like, How did that unfold?
To be honest, I never really wanted to do anything else. Like 12, 13, I was like, this is what I want to do. I for my sins, I was, you know, New Labour kid, so I managed to get, I went to university as the first in my family to do so. As I was at university, I did manage to graduate, but my ex-band Wild Beasts are kind of like, we're all boys from the same area, and we just used to practice 4 or 5 nights a week, gig twice a week, go all over the place.
When you were students, were you gigging?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, like, yeah. between you know, and also part-time work as well. So like, there wasn't a lot of time, but we were serious. You know, we took it really seriously first off, and we wrote our own songs, and we were.
Which university? Whereabouts?
As Leeds University.
Oh, okay, so right.
At the time, it would be like, you know, the sort of. There's a lot of attention. Suddenly, a lot of attention leads. I think because of the sort of nouveau Britpop bands, like, you know, the Kaiser Chiefs being.
I was wondering whether they would be gigging at the time that you were around.
Yeah, they were already massive, but they've threw us a few bones. They sort of said that we were a new band coming up in Leeds and we were really good. And there's lots. I mean, you know, I mean, it'd be a mistake to think. I mean, you live in Sheffield, so it's similar, but like, it'd be a mistake to think of like it having a sound, that town. Do you know what I mean? There's just a lot of people who are quite supportive, and it's, you know, there's no career, quote unquote, there. Do you know what I mean? You got to go south. Unfortunately, you do hit that northern Glastonbury.
Yeah,
I say that with no pleasure at all, because I'm, you know, I've lived down south quite a long time, but I think I've retained my accent and outlook. So
I'm going to talk about your vowel sounds a bit later on with one of the songs, because I there's one thing. Well, let's talk about it now. There's one thing I really like. It's when a northern singer pronounces love, or come on, love and stuff like that. And I was listening to one of your songs earlier today, and it reminded me a little bit of Guy Garvey. Does it? Quite a lot.
I mean, that's a huge compliment. He's got a wonderful voice, and he leans on that Manchesterness a lot.
There's so, just something about that vowel sound that makes me feel warm and reassured. I was trying to sort of say, well, where's that come from? And I was like dredging back. I thought it's elbow. It's that Guy Garvey thing.
Well, I think that something I've tried to do in my writing, I think I've sort of done better as I've got older, is like, you know, Americans write this, for example, because they have long vowels and can drag stuff out and stuff, whereas like, you know, there's that folk singer way of going up that crack, you know, that kind of dang, dang, ding, ding. And I try and write like that. So like, lyrics tend to be a bit rapid fire. There aren't a lot of long notes, which is great because I've got no technique as a singer. And like, you know, and it just kind of, it just gives you a different way of approaching it, I think.
So have you had any formal training, or is your musical career as a result of that self-exploration? And
as a kid, I did. As a kid, I had like piano lessons. I mean, my parents were desperate to put me in a classical instrument, so eventually this way to settle on classical guitar. But like cello, clarinet, saxophone, piano was discussed. But like guitar-wise, it was all rock bands, really. I wanted to play chords and stuff, and then. As you get older, of course, you realise all music's connected. And so you can kind of start to put things together a bit. And one thing begets another.
So how easy is it? Well, let's go back then. So you were in the band, and the band split up. So at that point, how did you sort of think, how can I keep this going? I presume you wanted to, because you're here today and we're having this conversation. So how concerned were you that the safety net of having a group of people around you versus being a solo artist?
I think more than I realised. I think that because I've got friends who are solo artists, and like, I used to wonder what the hell the problem was. It's fine. You know, it's like, and you know, the kind of like internal monologue that goes on, which, you know, everyone's got a monologue of self-doubt to an extent, but like musicians tend to drive on ego and doubt. And like, I was like,
well, you know, so when you're on your own, you have to believe in yourself, presumably.
You do, yeah. And it's you have to be realistic, and you have to. I think it helps me having been in the industry a little while.
Yeah,
like, you know what you are a bit better. You know your shortcomings,
and you've got a network. And
yeah, exactly. So there's a professional aspect to that, but there's also like you know what you are, and you know what you're doing a bit better, and like, you know where your influences are, you know what you're interested in, rather than just being like, here's all music, do something. You know, you kind of know better what you are as an artist, so you can kind of try and focus all that nervous energy a bit better.
So when you were at that point then where you're sort of saying, right, I'm going to carve out my career, and you came up with this stage name, shall we sort of say, of One Tree Pairing. So tell me a little about the evolution of that and what the thought process was there. Why not Fleming?
Well, I mean, firstly, there's a very famous Irish singer called Tommy Fleming, who does like very kind of like, you know, sings to like in leisure centres to old ladies, like basically, you know, Daniel O'Donnell style. So I didn't want to get too confused.
There's not much of a crossover there, is that what we're saying?
No, exactly. Apart from him having, you know, him. I mean, I don't know if I'm Irish, but look at me. So like, you know, but. apart from that, I think I wanted it to be not. I'm very allergic to the idea of being like a quote unquote singer songwriter, despite being one. Yeah. So like I kind of stepped back from that, wanting to give it a project name so we can do what I want with it. If I decide I'm not going to sing anymore, or if I, you know, want to get right. more people involved, right. then I can do
that.
So
you can collaborate with whoever you want, and that will result in, it still comes under that banner of one true pairing kind of thing.
Yeah, I know it's probably a bit pompous and pretentious on my part, but that's like, you know, it's, you know, I'm a product of my era, you know. But I think that, that kind of came up all at once. I think I'd sort of, if I was going to do that, I didn't want it to, and I don't want it to be just like, oh, this is my diary. Nothing more boring than that. You know what I mean? I want it to be something I've made rather than something I am, you know? Yeah. And even though, I mean, I know that line is a dotted one, but like, that's what I'm trying to do.
Okay. So you put out your first solo album in 2019.
Yeah, a while ago now.
And then COVID. My understanding in the music industry, and feel free to correct me these days, is obviously the money that is generated from Spotify and Apple and all the rest of it is 0.00001 pence per play, and bands increasingly are looking to tour to make money.
Well, they were, and now that is going the same way. And I think that, to be honest with you, I think that with, you know, for example, the advent of AI and zero hours and all that kind of thing, I think the musicians have been the canary in the coal mine for some years, and nobody was listening in terms of, you know, tech bros taking the things you care about and smashing them up. I think that's, you know, musicians were kind of ahead of the curve in that regard. And I think more and more industries are seeing that now. But it killed that album dead, to be honest with you. It's not like it was, you know, it was in many ways a difficult listen anyway, so I think I didn't have.
Had you planned to tour to promote it?
Yeah, and I did manage to do a short one. Then all hell broke loose. So you know, I remember, you know, the Nightingale Hospital was being built and the hazmat suits and, like, you know, the live counter on TV and stuff. It was, you know, it was harrowing, you know, and I think it was like, I think it had a pretty lasting effect on my head as well, in which I didn't really appreciate at the time.
You and a lot of people, but, I suspect, as well, yeah.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, I did get COVID in the first wave, so, like, when I was living in London at the time, at the very tail end of it, and, like, you know, before any vaccines or anything like that, and, like, the advice was essentially, stay in your room, try not to die. So I was like, cool, right, okay.
How old are you? I
got a couple of underlying health conditions as well, so it was like, let's see what happens here. And it was pretty frightening, because you don't know what's coming. You know?
No, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. In many respects, it feels like yesterday, but a decade ago.
This is it. I mean,
the last 3 years has been something of a blur. But
time compresses, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So now we're at the point where you are able to get out there, and your venues are going to get. Certainly, again, I know we had this conversation just before we started, but the sort of like the grassroots music venues seem to be under threat these days. How easy is it to put a tour together or to just play live these days? How are you finding that?
I mean, it's harder than it was, definitely. I think that, like, for example, at the height of Wild Beast, we'd make a record, and if it did well, we could tour it for 18 months or something. I think that period's got a lot shorter these days. It is concerning to see, you know, long-established independent venues. Like, there's one in Bath went down recently, which we played at way back in the day and launched careers of, you know, dates back to sort of the 70s and the punk era.
Yeah.
Like, this is happening. It's going to happen in a lot of places, I think. I mean, you've already seen it in London, obviously, with the insane property prices. You can't, unless you are a property developer, you can't open a venue, really.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
Something on, I still call it Twitter. I saw something on Twitter the other day where there's a venue in Dublin, and there'd been a redevelopment of some flats next to it, and the people who bought those flats last year are putting an objection to the music license being renewed, and the venue has been open for decades. You know,
it's a repeat exactly what happened in Hackney, like, and probably is happening in Brixton as well, in London, Northern Quarter in Manchester, saw the same thing, like the Night and Day Cafe.
Yeah,
it's just like, this is it. Deepest pockets win. you know, every time, and it's pretty miserable. I mean, let's be honest, like the world and this country in particular, well, sorry, both this world and this country are not doing too well at the moment.
Yeah, as the Chinese curse would have it, may you live in interesting times, and we certainly are, aren't we?
Yes, absolutely. I think that interesting times are difficult to live through. Do you know what I mean? I'm not a believer in that old cliche that like, oh, great, you know, hard times make great art. It's like you need support. You can't create if you're struggling to make ends.
Well, I'm of a generation where there was the YTS scheme and various other things you're reading biographies of musicians who were in the 60s sort of saying, I could only do what I did because I was able to claim 16 quid a week or whatever it was back in the 1970s, and that enabled me to doss around with my mates and learn three chords. I haven't thought of it like that, but out of that comes a burgeoning creative arts scene that then ends up generating revenue and making people...
It became like, we used to be something, well, I guess it is, but we used to be something that we really were good at, and it was worth a lot of taxpayer money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. It's
funny you investing things because you get returns.
It's mental. It's, I mean, obviously I've got a dog in the fight, so obviously I would say this, but it doesn't seem to make sense on any level, really.
But against all of that backdrop, notwithstanding that, you're still here, you're still making music, terrific
very
music,
so.
And you've got
very
a new single out. So tell us about your new single and tell us why people should listen to it and buy it more personally.
Oh my goodness, well my new single is entitled Midlife Crisis, and it's...
Autobiographical?
somewhat. I think we all think we're someone until the universe proves us otherwise. Do you know what I mean? So there is a sense of... I'm trying to capture that kind of frustration of wonder, of like looking around, getting a certain age and looking around you and going like, well, what have I got actually? What am I for? And like, it's that period whereby your youth is a, like, as you say, like, you know, it's yesterday, but it's also 10 years ago. Yeah. In your head, you're 25 years, and it's funny and it's tragedy.
Well, I'll tell you now, the next 20 years will go quickly for you. Just take that, make of those what you can.
Yeah, I'm not under any illusions about that. And before that...
Go on, sorry.
No. I wanted to mention the single I put out before that, which wasn't not a conventional single, but it was a track called Frozen Food Centre, which is sort of semi-autobiographical about, you know, growing up in a small town and fate and persistence of memory and frozen food.
And I think that's the one, when I listened to it, I got at the beginning of it, again, I'm giving my age away now, there were bits of the acoustic guitar at the beginning that reminded me of Led Zepp 4.
So
like Jimmy Page, and then the sweeping strings came in, and that took me back to Elbow, and then your vowel sounds, and I thought, ah, right, great, I've made that connection now. I can see what's going on here.
All the cheap land out by the reservoir, near where the airport stretches out, the past is an island try to escape from. All the ghouls, 10 years your senior, ghosts in the aisle with a frozen food center.
But it is a terrific song. But the new one,
thank you.
The Midlife Crisis, the line in there that resonates with me is, I don't know where the time goes. That's the hook line, and my word, yeah, as I say, the next 20 years you will find that's certainly...
I keep my mouth closed. Midlife crisis. Let's fool the peak lying behind you. Midlife crisis.
So what was it made you sit down and write that song at this point in your life?
Well, I mean there is inevitability of like the sort of the feeling of getting older and sort of abandoning your youth. Do you know what I mean? But also, like, I guess, like, a kind of, I'm really not interested in writing about highfalutin things per se. Do you know what I mean? I really want to write about how that interacts with normal stuff and normal life and stuff which isn't on the map and stuff which, you know, like small town boy, small town club, you know what I mean? It's like, is that sense of like shared experience and also like the ordinariness. And I know that sounds stupid, but because I'm not coming at it from like a kind of like art school, oh, this is normal. It's just like, I'm trying to find a beauty in my own experience. Do you know what I mean? And trying to find something relatable in that and try and find the core of what that is. I mean, it's a life's work, all this stuff, you know, once you start, you pull the thread.
No, that's fair play to you. Well, lastly, but by no means least, where can people buy this stuff? Where do they go to find out more about One True Pairing?
Well, One True Pairing, I mean, there's a website, onetruepairing.co.uk. There's an Instagram. You can also find all the music, all your usual streamers. You've got Apple Music, Spotify, Amazon, Tidal, all that lot. YouTube has got beautiful videos for both tracks.
Yeah.
So my label is Domino, which is a wonderful transatlantic label. That's all of their website, all the information. Please, if you prefer a louder sound, please have a look at Wild Beasts. You know, also involved in that.
Other flavors are available. Yes,
exactly.
Well, we'll put links to all of that in the show notes so that people can go through.
Thank you.
And we'll play out with your a little clip from your latest single, I think, just to give people a flavor for that. But Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure. As I say, I love talking to creative people because I wish I was one. I love talking to musicians because I wish I was one. I love talking to Rovers fans. I am definitely a Rovers fan. So at least one out of three ain't bad, as Meatloaf so very nearly sang. It's been a pleasure chatting. Thank you very much for giving it your time.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
All the very best with your career in future. And if you ever play live in Sheffield, don't hesitate to drop me a line and ping me and I'll come down and see you performing there. So, Tom, wonderful. Thanks once again.
Thanks again. Midlife crisis. Let's full peak lying behind you. Midlife crisis. Life is short and goes on forever. Die or live to regret. Every challenge like a rock.
So if you ever feel like writing a jingle, don't hesitate. we will give you reciprocal publicity.
To be honest, it would be my most important work to be like.
I think Rovers need a new club song, so I think the Wild Rover, I think, has served as well. We probably could do with something else, but
do a little modernisation, maybe.
Yes, yeah. Well, if the muse ever takes you, don't hesitate.
We're saving for the staying up party.
Absolutely, yeah. Or would we beat Burnley next season?
Which we will.
Absolutely. Tom, thank you once again. Appreciate
pleasure.
You.
Four Thousand Holes in Blackburn, Lancashire. It's from a Beatles song. Give it a listen.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates around. You've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Your mates already got booked for double dipping, and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus. Serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.